This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, live from London with Owen Bennett-Jones. And coming up, Sir Paul McCartney on how AI will affect the ability of musicians to make a living.
AI is a great thing, but it shouldn't rip creative people off. There's no sense in that. Why would a government want to do that? I don't get it. So, you know, if you're putting through a bill, make sure you protect the creative thinkers, the creative artists, or you're not going to have them.
More from him later, but first, Rwandan-backed rebels in the M23 militia are advancing on the city of Goma in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo near the Rwandan border. Now, yesterday we heard there was fighting near the airport. Today, the airport is closed. People were going out of Goma, some still are, but others are now coming in from surrounding areas. The UN Security Council has held an emergency meeting on this. UN Chief Antonio Guterres said Rwandan forces should withdraw from the DRC and stop supporting M23. Well, speaking just a few hours ago, the DRC's Foreign Minister, Therese Kayekwamba-Wagner, was scathing about the lack of interest from the UN in the conflict.
For the past 3 years, the Security Council has failed the Congolese people. It has not acted, it has not held the people accountable who are directly linked to the chain of commands linking the RDF and the M23, chain of commands that lead all the way back to Kigali. For the past 3 years, we have been raising the alarm. And yes, we have taken note of how long it took the different partners that we are working with, the different partners that we believe share our ideals. We are cognizant of the fact that it took them a very long time. It's not just an issue of the Secretary General. When you look at the Security Council, we still have permanent members that have yet to utter the word Rwanda.
Well, the Foreign Minister then described what's happening in Goma.
The situation on the ground right now is that a city with millions of civilians is being taken in an onslaught by the Rwandan Defense Forces and the M23. And the reality right now is, yes, maybe Rwanda is concerned with its territorial integrity, but the DRC is the country whose territorial integrity is being violated by Rwanda. It is the DRC and the Congolese people who are being killed right now, and Rwanda is responsible for that. And this is just a very shameful way to respond or to shy away from responding to such a responsibility that Rwanda bears. But we take note of that. And again, history will never forget and probably not forgive.
So strong words in New York. Now, Nde Khadi Low is the spokeswoman for MONUSCO, the UN force supporting the DRC National Army. And she spoke to me from Kinshasa. Several peacekeepers have been killed in recent days, including some from that UN force. And I asked her how many and in what circumstances.
We have lost three of our colleagues, two of which are from South Africa and one from Uruguay. They have been killed on the battlefield while supporting the Democratic Republic of Congo's armed forces in their attempt to push back the M23 armed group.
So basically they've been killed by M23 fighters, is that correct?
Absolutely.
And do you know whether they've been killed by the Rwandan soldiers who are fighting with the M23?
The Secretary General of the UN has issued a statement today calling for the cease of territorial expansion of M23 and also calling for Rwanda to withdraw its forces in DRC. What it means is that we now calling for coordination in diplomatic efforts and military ones to end the hostilities in North Kivu.
And just for the moment, though, the fighting still continues, does it?
Yes, it does. It continues.
And how many of the MONUSCO forces are actively involved in that?
MONUSCO has a troop selling of more than 10,000, but they are in two provinces. Part of them are in North Kivu and others are in Ituri, where the protection of civilian mandate is being implemented.
Now, look, your peacekeepers have died. They've given their lives in the cause of trying to ensure stability in the Democratic Republic of Congo. But are they actually prevailing in that? I mean, it seems that You've got 10,000 soldiers, you've got the Congolese army. How come M23 is making such significant advances?
M23 has gained lots of territories since the beginning of the crisis. Remember, it was in June 2022 that they seized the town of Bunagana in North Kivu. Since then, it has not withdrawn, but it's expanding its territorial occupation of Eastern DRC. And also, we have the group of experts that have substantiated the support of the armed group from neighboring country. And as I told you, there is the involvement of external actors in the crisis in Eastern DRC. The Secretary General has also explicitly condemned the ongoing offensive by the M23, supported by the Rwandan armed forces.
Do you think there's a danger now that Goma will fall?
What I can say is that MONUSCO is maintaining its defensive position around and in the city to push back the M23 rebel group advance. And we are supporting with artillery, with helicopter attacks. We are also firing on M23 positions. But I can say that the pressure is very high on those defensive positions to prevent M23 to advance further in the city. But the pressure is very high.
And that was the spokeswoman for MONUSCO, Ndei Khadi Low. Well, Akili Mali Choma Choma is a local journalist in Goma. He's lived there all his life. He actually remembers the last time M23 took control of the city, but that was back in 2012 when he was just a child. Anyway, I asked him for the city's latest news.
The latest news we have right now is that the M23 advance and continue to progress near Goma, and that they could be near the base of the MONUSCO in Munigi, 15 kilometers from Goma right now. And in the night, the town is very dark as there is no electricity and there is no activity from people. It's only soldiers which are moving in the town, and the town is very quiet. Everything is closed, including bar and shops.
Okay, so are people expecting the army to defend Goma, or are they thinking M23 will enter the city?
People are really afraid about the possibility of the M23 to take the city, but people know that anything can happen. Today, in the day, there is a lot of panic in the people because there are some people trying to buy food, to take some water. They want to protect themselves. And people in Goma, they are really afraid, and they know that MONUSCO, the SADC and the FARDC, they are trying to do whatever they can to protect the town, but it's not enough because the M23 began from Bunagana and now it is in South Kivu. And when it's attacking Goma, now it's 3 days, people are really afraid.
Are some people trying to leave? I mean, presumably, if people are scared of the M23 coming, is it an option to go to the border checkpoint and go into Rwanda?
The border of Rwanda is still open. There are so many people which are using the border of Rwanda, which is open, to go to Rwanda and to try from there to take some flight and whatever, or to stay in Rwanda. Or there are also so many people which are trying to use a boat to go to the nearest town of Bukavu in the South Kivu to try to be far from this conflict.
And that was Akili Mali Choma Choma. Now, the journalist and writer Michaela Wrong is an acknowledged expert on the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda, and I asked her, does she think there's anything the international community can do to end this fighting in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
We have been here before. We were here in 2012 when the M23 in a previous iteration actually went into Goma. At that stage, what happened is there was a big flurry of alarm on the part of the international community. And very abruptly, very suddenly, all Western aid to Rwanda was cut off, and $240 million worth at least of aid was suddenly halted. The World Bank was involved with that, so was the IMF. And it's had a really dramatic and very beneficial impact because Rwanda, people tend to forget that Rwanda is very heavily aid dependent. And so if it faces an aid boycott by its closest allies, it really has to react to that. And I think what's been really baffling and puzzling and confounding to analysts and people like me is why the international community hasn't done anything approaching that this time around when we've seen the similar build-up and similar levels of violence.
Even if you're baffled, can you try and explain why the donor countries are not trying to rein Rwanda in?
So many of these governments have interests now. And so what you saw here in Britain is during the entire period when we had the Conservative government here was hoping to send illegal migrants to Rwanda, have them processed in Rwanda and stay there. There was no way the British government was going to utter a word of criticism of what Rwanda was doing in Congo. Similarly, France is very beholden to Rwanda because Rwandan troops have deployed in Mozambique, where there's a major, massive liquefied gas installation owned by Total, and they have brought peace to that region, and France is very grateful for that. So the French have rewarded the Rwandans with generous aid package in 2024. Nominally, you get statements by the French saying, oh, you know, the Rwandans really have to stop doing what they're doing in Congo. They never follow up with any form of sanctions. And then the most vocal players have been the states. And the states have been deeply critical, deeply increasingly critical of what Paul Kagame is doing inside Congo. But the states is otherwise preoccupied, as we know right now, you know, with the incoming Trump administration. And then, you know, its focus is really on Ukraine and Gaza. So Congo comes very low down on this list. And I think Paul Kagame is very aware of that. And the timing of this this major surge is not coincidental. He's looking at the states and he's thinking our biggest critic is currently otherwise engaged. They're not going to be focusing on this.
If the Rwandan-backed forces, M23, do take Goma, what will that mean? What will happen? And what will it be like in Goma?
Well, Goma is a major hub. It's really the key hub in the Kivus. There's a major airport there. It's where all the NGOs are based. It's where the flights go in, where, you know, the UN, MONUSCO, the UN force has an important headquarters there. But I think people are looking at this as something much bigger than just the fall of Goma. People are anticipating, the analysts I speak to are sort of saying Goma will be first. Bukavu, which is the southern capital, will be next. And what they are saying to me is that they have gone from thinking that the M23, which was seen for years as just Kagame's way of kind of keeping leverage over DRC and also keeping a sort of claim on the minerals that are smuggled out of that part of DRC, that now there's a different agenda, that the M23 is actually going to bring about the de facto annexation of North and South Kivu.
And that was Michaela Wrong there. And actually, since she was speaking, news coming in from Agence France-Presse that they have heard gunfire and explosions in Goma as M23 approaches onto the city. You're listening to NewsHour. And coming up, Arab leaders have rejected a proposal by US President Donald Trump for more than a million Palestinians to be moved from Gaza. We'll hear the reaction of the chairman of Arab Americans for Trump.
I believe that he is the most pragmatic individual in his administration, and he is the most realistic one. What I'm saying is that the idea that was floated of transferring Palestinians, whether to Indonesia, Egypt, or Jordan, is unrealistic because the Palestinians do not want to leave their land.
And other headlines, President Trump says he'll impose emergency tariffs and sanctions on Colombia after it turned back two migrant deportation flights. And the US Vice President, J.D. Vance, has said he hopes raids on schools will have a chilling effect on undocumented migrants. You're listening to NewsHour. The leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, was looking for another presidential term in the elections in that country today. And with next to no opposition allowed, he is certain to win the presidency. Now, last time, in 2020, he got 80% of the vote. This time, there's an exit poll, 87.6, getting more popular, it seems. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, is in Minsk. he told me about Presidential Election Day.
It was very bizarre, actually. I've reported on many elections in many different places, and, you know, I've seen prime ministers and presidents kind of rolling up at polling stations and casting their ballots and taking a few questions from reporters, but I've never seen anything quite like the scene I witnessed at the polling station in Minsk today. So Alexander Lukashenko cast his ballot, and then from another room in the building, he gave a 4.5-hour press conference live on state television. You know, while the voting was going on, Belarusians were still voting, and here you had candidate Lukashenko dominating state television on the day of the election. But it was an opportunity to sort of ask him, well, some questions about this controversial vote. So I asked him. The first thing he said to me was, "What wretched question have you prepared?" Like you always do.
Yes, okay.
To which I replied, "Good morning." and then I kicked off with, "How can you call this a democratic election when your main rivals are either in prison or in exile?" Mm. And he replied by saying, "Well, some are in prison and some are in exile, but you're here. Everyone has the right to choose. That is democracy." But of course, if you go back to 2020 and the brutal crackdown launched by the authorities on protesters who were accusing Mr. Lukashenko of stealing the 2020 presidential election, personal choice didn't come into it. Some were arrested and jailed, others forced into political exile. And then I pointed out that just a few days ago, Mr. Lukashenko had said, "We mustn't shut people's mouths." In other words, we mustn't silence people. But I said, "Your rivals haven't just been kept off the ballot. Some of them have been jailed. And in fact, there are more than 1,200 political prisoners in Belarus right now." I told him, "Isn't it time to open the prison cells and release them?" And I listed some of the most prominent political prisoners, people like Viktor Babariko and Maria Kolesnikova and Sergei Tikhanovsky. And he said, "Mouths are one thing, but prison is for people who have opened their mouths too wide and broken the law. What, don't you have prisons in Britain and America?"
I see another quote here. "I don't give a damn about the West. I'm willing to talk to the EU, but not to bow before you or crawl on our knees."
Yes. One of my questions to him was, America, the EU, Britain do not recognise you as the legitimate president of Belarus after what happened after the 2020 election. And I asked him whether he had any hopes that that situation, that attitude would change with the Trump administration. And he basically said, I don't care what you think of me. The most important thing to me is what the people of Belarus think and whether they recognise the election. This is a theme he's come out with for several years now, basically rejecting, dismissing the criticism coming from the West of his government and of his actions, and pushing on with power.
You mentioned there were protests last time. Are you expecting any this time?
No, not expecting any protests. In fact, the Belarusian opposition in exile, people who fled, people like Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, have said that it's far too dangerous now in Belarus to come out and protest. So the opposition is not calling for protests. Many of the opposition in exile asked people to vote against all the candidates. Now, there were five candidates on the ballot, Mr. Lukashenko plus four others. The others came across more as spoilers, really, than serious challengers. I mean, I met a couple of them early this week. And just to give you a little flavour, one of the candidates, the leader of the Communist Party, he actually said to me that he was a supporter of Alexander Lukashenko, the man he was running against.
Elections Belarus style. BBC Russia editor Steve Rosenberg. The former Beatles, Sir Paul McCartney, has told the BBC that proposed changes to copyright law could make it impossible for musicians and artists to make a living. AI developers want to use all the content that's out there on the internet, text and music, to generate their projects and their profits. But that overlooks the fact that as things stand, people own that content. They have copyright over what they created. Sir Paul McCartney has been talking to Laura Koonsberg.
Just worried about the copyrights not being protected, because if it gets a bit like the Wild West, then the people who created these copyrights don't benefit. And I think that takes away a lot of incentive, you know, because when we were kids in Liverpool, we found a job that we loved, but it also paid the bills.
What do you think the risk is for the next generation of musicians coming through?
So, for instance, you get young guys, girls, coming up and they write a beautiful song and they don't own it and they don't have anything to do with it. And anyone who wants can just rip it off. I mean, the truth is the money's going somewhere. You know, and it gets on the streaming platforms. Somebody's getting it and it should be the person who created it.
And if you hadn't been paid, then maybe the world wouldn't have ever heard Yesterday or Let It Be or Hey Jude.
You know, that is really true, because you like to think of art as the muse. You know, it's just the muse comes to me. It's not like that.
And actually, you used the kind of machine learning technology to help produce the song you put out last year to, you know, recreate mm-hmm. John Lennon's vocal performance from something from 1970. So what would you say to someone who say, well, look, you're being a Luddite, you're just, you know, sticking your heels in because you don't like the idea of progress?
Yeah, I get that, you know, and I think AI is great and it can do lots of great things. As you say, you know, we took an old cassette of John's and cleaned his voice up, so it has its uses. But my worry is in this rip-off area. You know, that was John's thing. He was in the Beatles. His widow gave us the tape. So there was no question of sort of copyright. Mm-hmm. But when you get, if you take that and then rip it off. See, for instance, I think I'm on the internet singing God Only Knows by the Beach Boys. But I never sang it. But AI made me sing it. So somebody's getting some sort of payoff there, and it's not me. I'm not interested. But I was talking to someone, and I said, you know, it didn't sound like me, not quite. But to casual observers, it's me singing God Only Knows. But I said to this person, I said, yeah, but, you know, give it 5 years, and it's going to sound exactly like me. And the guy said, one. Give it 1 year. And it's true. It's going so fast that, you know, you are going to, they're going to be able to put my voice on anything, anybody's voice on anything. So I think you just have to worry about the rip-off. AI is a great thing, but it shouldn't rip creative people off. There's no sense in that. Why would a government want to do that? I don't get it. We're the people. You're the government. You're supposed to protect us. That's your job. So, you know, if you're putting through a bill, make sure you protect the creative thinkers, the creative artists, or you're not going to have them.
As simple as that.
If there's such a thing as a government, it's their responsibility, I would think, to protect the young people, to try and enhance that whole thing so that it works, so that these people have got jobs and can enhance the world with their wonderful art. So protect it.
And speaking up for the next generation of creatives and musicians, that was Sir Paul McCartney. And welcome back to NewsHour. Now, amidst all the other uncertainties in the Middle East, a 60-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah has just come to an end. Under the deal, Israeli troops and Hezbollah fighters were due to have completed their withdrawals from southern Lebanon, and instead the Lebanese army would be deployed alongside UN peacekeepers. But it hasn't happened. Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon are now accused of killing at least 22 people trying to return to their homes. Well, I've been speaking to Andrea Tenenti, spokesperson for UNIFIL, the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon. How many Israeli troops are still in southern Lebanon?
Well, according to the agreement, the cessation of hostilities agreement, today was the last day. So we have no indications on how much longer the IDF will be staying in South Lebanon. This is an issue that now has been dealt by a mechanism that has been created 2 months ago and is chaired by the US and France at the moment. So I understand that the main stakeholders are in conversation right now to try to find solutions. What we are seeing right now is still presence of IDF in several villages in the south of Lebanon. And that, of course, makes very difficult for the Lebanese army to be able to be redeployed. Today, of course, the escalation of violence is again increasing the concerns for deterioration of the situations and also the further escalation. So we are on the ground at the moment together with the Lebanese army to try to de-escalate the tension.
Did UNIFIL see the incidents in which people were killed trying to get back to their villages?
We are on the ground with the Lebanese army at the moment. So we have seen the incidents and reported some of the incidents. Of course, in some of the areas, the presence is only of the Lebanese armies, but we also have been deployed at the request of the Lebanese army across several parts of the area of operation to try to prevent any further escalations. But the management of the crowds of the civilian remains outside our mandate. This is something for the Lebanese army to deal with. We don't have that mandate of dealing with the civilians in South Lebanon.
I think it would help to have some ideas of the numbers involved in all of this. How many UNIFIL personnel are there in southern Lebanon?
In southern Lebanon, at the moment, we have a little bit less than 10,000 troops from 48 different countries. Of course, some of these areas where our contingents are based, they have limited monitoring capabilities because of IDF presence. So it's very difficult to be able to deconflict some of these activities.
10,000 is a lot. I mean, and how many IDF do you estimate are there and Lebanese army?
I don't know how many IDF soldiers. I know that the Lebanese army are redeploying to the south. We are able to go inside the villages where they're left by the IDF and left redeploying. I guess about the Lebanese army, around 1,500, 2,000 troops at the moment, and they are increasing the numbers in order to be fully deployed in all this area. But as I said, IDF are still present in most of the villages and areas along the blue line.
And that was Andrea Tenenti. He is the spokesperson for the UN force in Lebanon. You're listening to NewsHour. When a US president speaks, the world hears him. And that is certainly the case with the remarks of Donald Trump made on Air Force One last night. He was talking about the people who live in the Gaza Strip. And just before assessing the significance of what he said, let's hear his words.
I'd like Egypt to take people, and I'd like Jordan to take people. You're talking about probably 1.5 million people. We just clean out that whole thing, and I don't know, it's something has to happen. It's literally a demolition site right now. Almost everything's demolished, and people are dying there. So I'd rather get involved with some of the Arab nations and build housing at a different location where they can maybe live in peace for a change. Could be temporarily, could be long term.
Well, that suggests that the long-standing commitment to two states by the US, already rejected by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is being significantly revised. This is obviously a long-standing issue, but if you take as the starting point the creation of the State of Israel, then according to the UN, the displacement of Palestinians from land that was to become Israel turned 700,000 Palestinians into refugees at that time. Today, some 5.9 million Palestinian refugees are eligible for UN services. Well, Gada Al-Khoud is a journalist based in central Gaza at the moment. All of her grandparents, then in their 40s, actually left their hometown near the city of Ashkelon in Israel and were displaced to northern Gaza in 1948. Does she believe that people living in Gaza now will want to leave?
I think people of Gaza, they are aware now of what's happening in 1948. And I don't think people will accept to leave Gaza for a long-term period. They will struggle to live under difficult circumstances because they already been displaced for more than 15 months. I mean, not all of them, maybe some of them, they will leave Gaza like for personal interest. But most of the people here, they are poor people, they are suffering from difficult circumstances, and maybe they will not be able to live outside of Gaza. They will not be able to adapt in Arab or foreign countries. They are attached to the land of Gaza and will not accept this.
So that's a reaction from Gaza. What about the region? Gamal Rojdi is a spokesperson for the Arab League. He is representing there the General Secretary. Now, Palestine is a member of the Arab League, and the League says one of its aims is to safeguard the independence and sovereignty of its members. I asked for his reaction to Donald Trump's comments.
We are against the replacement of Palestinians from the Palestinian land, and we consider this against the notion of a two-state solution and the notion of an independent Palestinian state.
Do you have the power to enforce your views?
Of course, these positions by Mr. Trump are kind of a new American position. We need some deliberations among the Arab countries in order to see how to respond to this new policy, because it goes against the long-standing American position on this two-state solution.
So what about the foreign policy establishment in the US? How are they reacting? People like Richard Haass, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations, US foreign policy think tank. He's a veteran US diplomat. What does he think of what President Trump has said?
I would argue it's unfortunate. When it comes to the Palestinians, they're not interested in living lives outside of Gaza or the West Bank, what they would call Palestine. What they want is a very different life than the one they've lived for the last, what, half century or more there. Also, there's the danger. The process could demographically and politically destabilize, above all, Jordan, which is already roughly 60 to 70% Palestinian. It could also have some impact on Egypt, which is, you know, always experiencing, shall we say, difficulties, largely because of the combination of the large population and the poor economy. I also worry about the signal it sends to those in Israel, the settlers and their supporters in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, who essentially believe there's no place for satisfying any Palestinian aspirations, and instead they advocate for Israeli annexation and the transfer of these people out. You know, I just worry that you put all this together, and I just don't see how this is going to build any momentum towards a political settlement.
What would you say to the argument that, you know, many people outside of the US and Israel might put forward that Biden gave a complete blank check to the Israelis over the last presidential term and Trump's doing the same? It's a continuation, really, of US policy.
Well, if you were to take a step back over the last several decades, you could argue that every American administration has been quite unconditional, not totally, but quite unconditional in support of Israel. And this seems to me, though, if you couple it also with a decision made on President Trump's first day, which was to rescind sanctions against the settlers accused of violence against Palestinians or illegally taking Palestinian or destroying Palestinian property. Then again, I worry about the signals that it sends. So the Biden administration, even though I would argue was insufficiently tough on the nature of the Israeli use of force in Gaza, not on their right, but how it was exercised, I think, yes, this is a step even more in the direction of essentially telling the Israelis, you shape the future of relations between Israelis and Palestinians as you will.
Do you have any sense of how much support there is for two states still in Israel?
Oh, it's on life support. It was already a distant hope or possibility before October 7th. October 7th has essentially destroyed for the time being the left in Israel or anyone who would be interested in accommodating Palestinian nationalism. And again, this kind of thing, talking about transfer, the idea that the Palestinian issue can somehow be solved apart from a compromise involving political rights on the territories of the West Bank and Gaza seems to me to be taking things in an even worse direction.
But do you think it'll happen, actually? Do you think there could be population transfer?
I've been working on the Middle East for half a century, and one of the things I've learned is not to rule anything out. You know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you it can't happen, and that's in and of itself worrisome. The idea that I can't rule that out as a possibility is in itself somewhat, you know, some would say, alarming.
You are very familiar with American foreign policy and the foreign policy process, and been, you know, dealing with it for decades. And we now have this comment, which we've been talking about, which was basically made on Air Force One, you know, off the cuff, maybe. And now there is this spat with Colombia, which has resulted in a tweet or a message on Truth Social saying, emergency 25% tariffs on all goods, 50% in a week on Colombia, travel ban on all the leading Colombian officials because they turned back a couple of planes with deportees. We're in a new world, and it seems to have worked, by the way. The Colombians apparently are sending a plane to pick up the deportees.
Well, to me, it tells you several things. One is the deportation policy is not simply a policy of declaration or design. There's also implementation issues. And you've got to get countries willing to accept individuals. And Colombia may have decided it wasn't in a position to resist American pressure, economic pressure in particular. But other countries might. For example, I'm not sure such an approach, say, would work with Mexico, which has all sorts of ways of pushing back. But this, you know, this is essentially a new, more assertive, more aggressive American foreign policy. It's consistent with some of President Trump's comments about about how he sees the relationship between the United States and the Western Hemisphere, and other countries will take note. So I expect it may lead to a certain degree of what, preemptive capitulation or compromise on the part of some, but it also may trigger something of a nationalist, anti-American backlash in places that have the are in a position to sustain such a policy. So I would essentially not overread into this as necessarily a precedent for everything that is to come.
And that was Richard Haass. The organization Arab Americans for Trump seems to have been thrown somewhat off balance by this Trump statement on Gaza. Just this morning, they issued a press release in which they said the president is the most realistic and pragmatic individual amongst all officials in his administration. They've now issued another one with a very different tone. It's headlined, "We firmly reject any call for the removal of Gazans to any country in the world." Well, Dr. Bishara Baba is the national chair of Arab Americans for Trump. And given that second statement, I asked him, is he now condemning what President Trump has said about Gaza?
You know, I am not condemning President Trump. I believe that he is the most pragmatic individual in his administration, and he is the most realistic one. What I'm saying is that the idea that was floated of transferring Palestinians, whether to Indonesia, Egypt, or Jordan, is unrealistic because the Palestinians do not want to leave their land.
With respect, in one answer, you've said that the president is realistic and that his proposals are unrealistic. So that doesn't really add up, does it?
Well, you know, the president is a realistic individual. What happened with that particular statement regarding the relocation, it was within a conversation between him and a podcaster. And I believe that a podcaster almost intentionally led the president to make such a statement. I mean, I believe that the president believes that the only resolution to the conflict is a two-state solution, an Israel and Palestine living side by side. That is something that he personally told me during a meeting I had had with him several months ago during the campaign.
That's because he wanted your vote.
Well, of course he wanted my vote and my community's vote. But at the same time, the president also promised that he would end the wars in the Middle East. And he started by enforcing the ceasefire. There was no way on earth that we could have had a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel had Kamala Harris won the presidency. But unfortunately, from my perspective, many of his advisors, with the exception of few, are hawkish. And once the president hears the facts and sees the facts, he would be also convinced that the only path to peace in the Middle East is a two-state solution.
Well, I mean, I realize that's what you think, but it doesn't seem to be what President Trump thinks. He's been very clear about it. The statement was unambiguous. It's hardly reasonable to blame a podcaster for asking him the question. He answered it. And the fact is the issue's slipping away from you, isn't it?
No, I mean, the president was also is a realistic individual. He talked about taking over Greenland, and you and I know very well that's not going to happen. So when it comes to the reaction of the Arab world, which I know that he's currently receiving and has been receiving since yesterday, it would be very clear to the president that that whole notion was a non-starter.
I'll just ask you a question, which I think many people would expect me to ask you, which is that as you did this in the campaign supporting President Trump, many people couldn't understand why you would do that. And I think they feel vindicated that, you know, it hasn't worked out in the way you would have wanted.
It's week one of the game. You know, we have 4 years to go.
And if he doesn't keep his promise to you?
We're going to be pressing, you know. There are elections that will be held next year for Congress. There will be elections held in 4 years for the Senate. And our vote counted very much in the last election, and it will count very much going forward and even more.
And that was Dr. Bishara Baba, the national chair of Arab Americans for Trump. Tomorrow is International Holocaust Memorial Day, and this year also marks the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi death camp Auschwitz. In addition to these camps, the Nazis established many ghettos where they imprisoned large populations of Jews, and one of those was Theresienstadt in what was then Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. Lenka Lichtenberg, a Czech-Canadian singer whose grandmother was imprisoned there, was able to bring her grandmother's poems, written there in secret during the war, back to the camp some 8 decades on. Michael Rossi sent this report.
We are standing right now in the loft of the Magdeburg Barracks, which is a building in Theresienstadt, or Theresien, that hosted the famous Theresien Cabaret. And it turned itself into a hub of culture and a place to both create new works and escape from reality. My mother, who was between the ages of 14 and 17 when she was here, and my grandmother, Hannah, and her husband, Richard, they were all incarcerated in Theresien for 2.5 years. And I do have a feeling that they would have come here.
Jsme věčně ztracení, věčně spasení.
What is this place? Where have we come to?
Za nocí nejtmavších na slunce pamatuj, pamatuj.
Those are words by Anna Hanna Frisova, a Czech poet who was imprisoned in the Nazi ghetto of Theresienstadt, or Terezín as it's known in Czech. Lenka was able to return with the poems of her grandmother, and those poems she set to music. The Nazis infamously created propaganda films at Terezín to give the impression that it was a spa town full of relaxation and culture, using the camp's actual rich cultural life to pretend to the visiting Red Cross that they treated the Jewish inmates well. Peter Rich, a guide at Theresien, describes the reality.
In the first moment when people came here, were brought here, they were split into the two categories, able to work, unable to work. And sad thing is that who didn't work? Sick people, old people, kids. So especially sick people and young kids were sent to extermination camps very often, I suppose.
Lenka Lichtenberg's grandparents' relationship was broken by the war, something that is reflected in the poems and in the songs.
My grandfather Richard was arrested by the Gestapo and he was in prison for 6 months. By the time they were leaving, going actually to Theresien, things were already bad like this.
Studený soumrak byl můj milý, když my dva jsme se loučili.
They do tell a story so much. You know, why would she be memorizing and adapting a poem about saying goodbye to someone leaving the next morning? That sounds very much to me like that would be her husband. It is a very powerful picture into her world and into her emotions.
For Lenka Lichtenberg, returning to sing her grandmother's poems at Theresien some 8 decades on is deeply meaningful.
Finding the poems in her booklets already made everything very real. It's become a part of my life more so than ever before. I have felt that my grandma and my mom have just come back to me, even though they have both passed.
Neživé bolesti šťastného okolí.
Music by the Czech-Canadian singer Lenka Lichtenberg, ending that report from Michael Rossi. Now, tomorrow, Tim Franks is going to be presenting NewsHour from the site of the Auschwitz death camps in Poland. He told me what he's seen there so far.
Owen, it's not the first time I've been to Auschwitz, and it is a place that I'm sure it's the same for everyone each time they visit. It is a place that you cannot emerge from without being shaken to the core. And that comes despite the fact that, you know, we're all familiar with the facts that Auschwitz was the site where close to 1 million Jews were killed in the space of a few years. There were other victims as well, but Jews were the overwhelming target. And it is the most notorious death camp out of the whole network of death camps and slave labor camps that the Nazis had, which saw 6 million Jews die. But nonetheless, just the very scale of the place, the vestiges that there are of the people who were processed through there, who were dehumanized, who were starved if they weren't gassed immediately, who were tortured and ill-treated. It is a gut punch each time. And it is the warning from history. And it is something both to conjure with in its own right, and it is also something that, of course, leaves many, many questions about how we deal with that now.
Right, and how it's being dealt with now, in part anyway, is by having world leaders attend. And I think they're gathering, probably tonight, are they, for events to mark the 80th anniversary of the liberation.
Yeah, but interestingly, and I think, dare I say it, it feels like completely correctly, the organiser of the ceremony, the director of the museum at Auschwitz, has said the voices that he wants to hear are not those of politicians. You would expect the bigwigs to stand up and say something meaningful about lessons from history and so on and so forth. He doesn't want that. He wants to hear the voices of survivors, because obviously now at this 80th anniversary, there are so few survivors left, relatively speaking. I think it's also, though, because, of course, what genocide means, what anti-Semitism means, has become such a fiercely contested issue, such a neuralgic issue. And I think he wants to steer clear of that and allow Auschwitz its moment to speak for itself.
And that was Tim Franks, who's going to be presenting NewsHour from the Auschwitz death camps on what will be the 80th anniversary of the liberation. And he brings us to an end of this edition of NewsHour. So thanks very much for listening. And from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice, and for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.